And then there was silence. I didn't hear it actually gulping. And then the noise again of the mosquito leaving. Right? And so my training is to try to live a good life. So if I knew that this was a malarial mosquito, because I've been in monasteries, there's malaria, no way I would have done that. I'd be out of there. I'm not stupid. Or if it was a tick, this is quite frightening actually now, with Lyme's disease in Ontario. I'd have a shower, whatever I have to do. So there's that part of our life which is engages with the conditions of reality in a way which is sensible, moral, generous, skilled in many, many ways. And we all do that to the very best of our ability in our vocations, in our families, in the way we relate to the larger issues, political, environmental, and so on. So Saturday we had a nice working bee at the monastery. We planted about 30 ornamental trees and shrubs, and I planted two trees for my mom outside my window, and I had a few of her ashes left over. I've had my mom's ashes now since she died in March 22nd, 2011, and I've really gotten a lot of mileage out of them. You might have know the story when my mom, before my mom passed away, some years before she passed away, she's from Latvia, and she said, well, take my ashes to the Atlantic and throw them in the Atlantic and maybe they'll float back to Latvia. It's a very poignant feeling for her life. So I took one portion of the ashes and did that. We went on a kayaking trip. And then I said, well, why not just take them to Latvia? So then a year later, I took them to Latvia. And then I went on pilgrimage to India. And I took some to India. But I got to India, I said, oh, Mom didn't like India, so I brought them back. So now I still, and her ashes, I didn't get them, you know, ashes you can get ground up or you can get them whole. You can get them fine grain, medium or coarse. You just ask the guy and he's delighted that someone's interested. Anyway, I went to the guy and I just picked out the bones I wanted and he ground the rest. You can do that. Well, we're so kind of protected from all that. They're my mom's bones. I can do what I want with them, right? So I had this good collection of bones and it's dispersed over the planet, so that I took the last bits and we planted these two trees for my mom. And these are the kinds of things we can do as human beings, which are in the conditioned realm, which are very beautiful and very uplifting and create a foundation for happiness and goodness in our lives. And all of us, I think, are looking at how we can live life in a way which is not just a sort of drudgery of survival, but has joy in it, has beauty in it. So, you know, planting trees and creating a shrub garden, these are lovely things to do. And they create a possibility in the heart of some kind of fulfillment, but they won't liberate you, right? So the trees that we planted got wind damage when they were shipped from Ottawa. All the ends are dead. So, you know, you have the lady who's organized, a Thai lady, Noy's organizing this. She's got the plan, beautiful plan. Trees arrive damaged, not badly, but disappointment. Disappointment. So there has to be something in our lives which isn't just about the manipulation of the conventional world for our own happiness. And that's not bad. Happiness is a good thing. Joy is a good thing. But if our life hasn't got something which transcends joy, and that you think, well, what could transcend joy? You think that would be the goal. But really, joy is a conditioned thing, and it depends upon so many other factors that you can't rely on joy. if you rely on joy, you're going to really get knocked about when your tree dies. So without dismissing joy or beauty or harmony, all those things which we dearly love, we realize that they are not a refuge. That's, you know, if you rely on the positive side of life, you're going to get hugely disappointed and probably cynical. So sometimes Buddhism sounds like we dismiss all of that, the beauty part. But it's not a dismissal, it's a caution. But where beauty has its place, where joy has its place, it creates a foundation for a deeper understanding, a deeper possibility. Because when the heart is imbued with generosity and gratitude and a sense of beauty, it doesn't want anything. It's not really needy. Whereas a heart which is very selfish and very acquisitive and very competitive and all the rest of it, or very depressed or whatever, it's very much bound by the heaviness of those things. And we all have to deal with them, and it's important to understand them. But the first thing that what we have from the Pali Canon, when the Buddha taught, the first thing he would recommend would be to people, practice generosity. The first thing he said, before morality, before meditation, before self-analysis, practice generosity. And I say that often, but to me that's very interesting because, you know, the generous heart is very contrary to the heart which is always manipulating events for self-fulfillment. So generosity is a very, very important part of the spiritual life. And not generosity as a duty, but as an insight. One of the insights I had with my mother was, it was hard for her to express her gratitude with generosity because she was not totally incapacitated, but she couldn't do much. And you could see that opportunity to serve and to give was very limited in her life. And I had a incredible opportunity to serve and give to her. So I was trying to invent things that I needed so she could buy things for me and my brother would get them and so on. And that's an important part of a life, both to be a recipient and be a giver. You have to have both, don't you? You know, the way we communicate with each other, or the way we love each other, to love someone, you have to also be able to receive love. To communicate with someone, you have to both receive communication and give communication. This is a very important part of our life. And the giving part is, when it's done through a sense of wisdom, then it's very freeing, isn't it? It's a very freeing kind of thing. Even if we don't need much, just a kind word, a kind gesture. And that creates a kind of foundation where one is able to do these more subtle kinds of contemplation. So in this meditation, I was suggesting, what was I suggesting? I said, so I do the same old thing all the time, so there's no new tricks in the bag, sorry. But I think it's important where I ask you to toggle between these two, sound, body, right? Go through the tune and see the change. But you also see what is constant, and that's presence, or consciousness, or awareness, whatever word you want to use. If you get caught up into the words, is awareness the same as mindfulness, is consciousness this? Like, waste of time, total waste of time. It's just thought. But what is it about us that right now we know we're here? Call it Mickey Mouse if you want. It doesn't really matter. Quite often, in philosophical discussions, well, is that really consciousness, or is that awareness, or is that mindfulness? Too complicated. But when I know that the mosquito is biting me, there is a discernment, you could say, right? There's a knowing, there's a presence, there's consciousness, I know what's going on. When the in-breath feels a certain way, that's different than the way of the out-breath. And that's discernment, presence, consciousness, intelligence of some sort. And what we focus on for the most of our lives is are the objects. the quality of the experience, the annoyance of the mosquito, the and a lot of it is just which is sort of very very much absorbed into the thinking mind, planning and organizing, fantasizing and all manner of stuff. Thought is an object. Thought is an object. It's a movement through consciousness, and it can be known. The mosquito bite is an object, can be known. Those all vary. They change in quality, in intensity, in character, but awareness does not change. That sense of presence, you know you're right here now, does not change. And it's not different for any of us. One person might be having a painful knee, another person might be feeling quite whatever, good or bad, but those qualities are different for each of us. Our gender is different, our ages are different, our family histories are different, what we ate today is different, and what we'll eat tomorrow is different, but that sense of presence and consciousness and awareness is the same. This is our unifying kind of principle. And the image I've been using in the monastery, Cyrus will remember this one, is you have a finger and a thumb, and they touch each other. Alright? Finger touches the thumb, and the thumb touches the finger. And then when they're not touching, you don't have that experience. The finger is the sense objects, and the thumb is the knowing. Go to the other finger, you need the thumb. It's just an analogy. It's not science. Analogies are for imagination. Touch the other finger, touch the other finger. But you need the thumb. So the thumb is liberation. The fingers are changing. They're coming and they're going in different ways. Touching in different ways. But the thumb, that's where it's at. That's really where it's at. It's not about the mosquito bite. Or not the mosquito bite. It's not about beauty. And it's not about ugliness. It's about the thumb. The thing about beauty and calmness and settledness, it allows you to notice the subtlety of that. If the mind is very depressed or upset or terribly greedy or excited or whatever, the conditions are so attractive that one doesn't notice the thumb. That's why meditation, we use very ordinary things. And just in the ordinariness of noticing the difference between an in-breath and an out-breath, and seeing there's a change there, and discerning that change, you begin to notice the unchanging. The awareness of change is unchanging. So this is another way of talking about thumbs up. So next time I do this, I'm referring to something more than just victory. All experience requires awareness, presence. The mosquito bite was unpleasant. It was not painfully unpleasant, just mildly annoying for a brief period, and then that was it. Getting insulted is a more challenging kind of mosquito bite. Getting cancer is even more. Having sickness in the family. Losing your job. These are profound things which spin us around something awful, and we have to deal with them. But all of them point to awareness. The most horrific to the most beatific experience requires presence. Can't exist without it. And that we don't tend to notice because we are so absorbed into our thinking, into our projects, in which we have to do that. We have to live this life in a reasonable way. And even the project of becoming a better person is good, but as I keep reminding folk, it's not the goal. It's the method. Compassion is the method. Morality is the method. Generosity is the method. Because the worst thing you want to do for meditation is be a bank robber, or a thief, or embezzler, or play around with six partners or take cocaine or lie or all those different things. The best thing you can do is be impeccable and generous, because that creates a stability. That creates a stability in the heart, a kind of self-respect, a sense of joy, a sense of goodness, a sense of living one's life in a good way. So the goodness is important. It's important, but that's not all there is. That's not all there is. And I often, I think Colleen sent me an article about mindfulness and some of the debates around that, and which is the kind of buzzword now, isn't it? Mindfulness and so on. And in the end of the article, the person said, "What about mindful fracking?" Where I heard about American soldiers who operate drones that bomb Afghanistan or wherever they do it, and they're taught mindfulness methods so they don't get stressed out. Bizarre. Totally bizarre. So the idea of mindfulness there is not a Buddhist idea, to say the least. My sense of awareness or presence is that you, like the breath, like Anapanasati, mindfulness of in and out, mindfulness of breathing in and out. To me, my sense of that is that you bear in mind the feeling of the breath, not for the breath, but for the awareness. You have something natural in the present moment, and you bear that in mind for the sake of knowing awareness, rather than for some kind of life efficiency, so you can make more widgets for Pepsi, so they can make more money. That's not what it's, that's not spirituality. That's just being an efficient worker. So the spiritual dimension, to me, if we use that word, and we have difficulty with language, like religion is a pejorative word, and spirituality sounds a bit airy-fairy, and what word do we use? What word, is there a dimension which is not about the conditioned realm? Is there a dimension which is not just about happiness? And there is. There is this capacity to turn attention away from the object to the very sense of presence. Now, what prevents us from doing that is the desire for objects. And that's why Buddhism speaks so strongly about the desire for objects. Not as a bad thing in a kind of evil or immoral way. It's just like the objects of sense have a usefulness. So I see there was a tick on, I was watering the plants this morning, and a tick fell off my robe onto the cushion. And that's a sense object, that's a sense experience. So what do? I went and chucked my clothing in the washing machine in a shower. I don't want Lyme's disease, right? So that's normal, that's the sense realm. And we live in that way. But is that all there is? Is there anything that is not dependent? And there is this beautiful presence in the silence of the mind. So the desire mind is a necessary thing. Like, I don't want to get Lyme disease, and I'm going to be darn careful not to get it. So just to say, you shouldn't have any desires is stupid. People say that about Buddhism. You shouldn't have any preferences. Sometimes they say that about Buddhism. Nonsense. I prefer a non-tick environment. Right? So, then you get some kind of really silly things around Buddhism because people don't understand what we're pointing to. It's not like people say we shouldn't have any preferences. I shouldn't have preferences. Not really. We all have preferences. We'd not be human. Sometimes Buddhism can sound like this sort of life of sawdust. That's a good one, isn't it? You can title the talk Life of Sawdust. as if we have, you know, that we don't like color, that we don't like fashion, that we don't like types of music or types of flowers or types of weather. We do, because we're human. It's only natural, only ordinary. But do we, is that the only thing? That's all. So do our preferences just addict us to more sense experience? Or do our preferences create a foundation for going to that which has no preferences, which has no color? All our preferences have color. All our experiences have color. Emotions have a color to them, a tone to them, a valence to them, don't they? I notice that the awareness of heat, the awareness doesn't stay hot, does it? The heat comes and goes. So the desire mind then is a natural function which we need to use biologically and aesthetically and so on, but the desire mind cannot liberate, because the desire mind is the mind which is going out into sense experience and choosing and selecting. It's fine. But if that's the only thing we do, if we only follow the desire mind, follow our appetites, that's a disaster. But even more so, if we're not able to look at desire as an object in itself, it never ceases. We never know its cessation. We just jump from one to another, from one to another, from one to another. Which is the addiction to sense experience. And one of the images I have, I call it the idolatry of experience. You know, if all experience is ultimately important, and the maximization of experience for our own fulfillment is the really important thing, then that's, to me, idolatry, because I'm focusing on sense experience as the place to be. Whereas if all experience points back to awareness, then that's symbology for me. Somebody's bringing me back home. All experience, beautiful or ugly. So without denying desire, desire needs to be understood. It's a useful function when you understand it. When it's not understood, it just drives us. Either repressive desires or whatever they, or indulgent desires, you don't have freedom. So to know desire as an object of mind is a more subtle kind of way of knowing life. Not judging it, not wrong, but also not just believing in it all the time. So the mosquito bites me on the cheek and my natural biological impulse is to get rid of it. But I can notice that. I can notice that, and the mind says, cool. The thing bites me and goes away. And what I've enforced is now, I haven't reinforced desire, I've reinforced awareness of desire. Now, if that mosquito had come to me, and kind of buzzed around, I went like that, just shook my head. It's not immoral, it's allowed. And then maybe you weren't watching, I went like that. That's, we usually try not to do that. Not good form. And if I did that, you'd be very disappointed in me. I'd probably get 40 letters. Sinful fellow, you. But more than just that, whether you know it's a moral thing, more than that is I have reacted through desire to something which will return, because that little fellow, he ain't finished with me till he gets my blood. And so he comes again, I shake my head and say, go to Andre. I try to use my powers of meditation. And we've all had this, haven't we? You know, and it just like drives you nuts, this little critter. And it just wants a bit of blood. And that's gross example is when we pursue desire rather than allow desire to cease. This isn't absolute. Again, if it was a tick, I use that desire to say this is dangerous, get out of there. It's not an absolute. It's an understanding of desire rather than an attachment to desire. One of the places where we can notice desire cease, and this is a very important idea, cessation in Buddhism, cessation has the sense of unending of a type of energy. And the great problem we have in meditation is the thinking mind. Because, you know, how much of this meditation was involved with useless thinking for all of us? Don't put your hand up. Powerful, isn't it? You know, I can make judgmental call or joking calls, but the thinking mind is very, very powerful. No denying. And it's driven by all kinds of energies and habits and so on. And one of the important things to learn as a contemplative or a meditator is what I suggested in this meditation was to notice the end of thought, to notice the cessation of thought. And that happens each time your thinking patterns are interrupted. We don't tend to notice it because then we often just, like a lot of us, it's a very Western thing, we just get into an analysis about the thinking or a judgment about, why am I thinking about that? Let's say if you have a unforgiving thought about someone, right? Your mind comes up, oh, stupid fool, I don't like them at all. And you notice that. You notice that thought. What happens? Isn't it true that for many of us, right after you notice that, you then say, I shouldn't be thinking like that? Do we not get into a kind of self-argument? Like, oh God, why am I thinking like that all the time? I'm not such a bad person. No, they're terrible. And it never ends, isn't it? Or maybe we analyze. What's the deep cause of this? Why do I do that all the time? It's more thinking. And what we don't notice is the cessation of thought. It's there. It's maybe only a finger snap, but it's there. Or we think that we're the thinker. Now, I shouldn't be thinking like this. And I've been saying this the last few weeks. If you're the thinker, then stop thinking. It's that simple. But you're not the thinker. Sometimes thought is deliberate. The most of thought is just conditioned by the stuff you were intending to do yesterday or your memories. It's just stuff. And when you try to stop being the thinker by thinking that you shouldn't be thinking and analyzing why you're thinking, you're just more thinking. Is that right? Yes? So to notice the end of the thought is very important meditation, very important. And to recognize that realization, this is the end, the cessation. And in that cessation, you also, if you're perceptive, you notice the end of ego, the end of self, the end of the narrative, the end of me and mine, because there's just pure awareness. That's all it is. The whole self-thinking is just thought. That's what it is. That's what's happening. And when that thought ends, there's the gap. There's the space. There's pure awareness. And we don't perceive that because our minds are so habituated to picking up the next thought, the next idea. Or as meditators, we then direct our attention to the object of awareness to get rid of the thinking, but we're still just fascinated by objects. But to actually notice the end of a thought, to notice the end of self, and just wait. Hey, I'm back. Great. Let it be a joyous thing or a congratulatory thing. Well done, Gurudamo. Whatever you want, but not negative. Just a sense of presence. So it's this way. And then listen. Feel, know, be. And then from that, then pick up the object of meditation. Not to get rid of thinking, but just to know awareness, to be aware. That's what you say, be aware. Huh? And I know for myself, when I was developing meditation early on, there was a very strong tendency to notice thinking and then try to focus on the object to get rid of the thinking. Very quick. But I never allowed myself just to notice, well, actually, you're all right already. Thought has already ceased. And just to taste that, and that's a very important moment. Taste it, just taste that moment. And that, when I start the meditation, I say, just listen. There, no thought. Nothing to do. And just stay there for 4 days. Hard to do. But that's what you're doing. You're just staying in the present moment for longer periods of time. And that's non-becoming, non-anticipation. You're not going anywhere. Very simple. And as one notices the cessation of self, the cessation of thought, you begin to touch the deep silence, which is always there, which is like always available. It's always there, as long as we're not distracted by conditions, the deep silence of the heart. And I think for me, that is what the spiritual life is about. Not just being a nice guy, that helps, but even if I'm a creepy guy, so I don't have any friends, as long as I live morally, right? So no one likes me. Okay, that's the karma of being creepy. But the awareness is still there. Can be, not necessarily, right? So it's even not about like being the perfect person. I think one of the great obsessions we have is this kind of idea that the voices in the mind will be this kind of lovely, perfect personality. Always sweet and compassionate, generous, sensitive, understanding. But you know, I don't know about you, I've got a whinger in there, I've got a complainer, I've got a worrier. I won't tell you other ones I have either. And are those realities? No. They're just echoes and habits. That's not who you are, is it? How often do we, you know, we have some horrible thought, but we don't act on it. Or we don't even speak on it many times, most of the time. We're actually good people. So the voices in you which are horrible and you don't want anyone to see, don't tell them about them. Don't tell anyone that you have these voices. Just know that that's not me. Rather than think it's some deep problem. I have this voice which says, you know, I should, that I hate everyone. That's just a voice. Don't believe it. Just be kind. We have a lot of fear sometimes of these inner voices. A lot of, like, concern about them. But they're just habits, personality habits. I know, like, my teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, he's 81 now. He's been practicing for 45, 46 years. And he says, I just don't believe my personality anymore. I just don't believe the rubbish. But it's interesting, the personality still arises. There are different kinds of voices come up. But they're just thoughts. And what's the balance? Is the balance having the perfect thoughts, the perfectly formulated, compassionate responses to all of life all the time? If you think that's the project, you're in trouble. You know, that's really, it's impossible. Because we're human beings, you know, we get the flu and people betray us and we have feelings and, you know, we're human. We can live morally and generously. But if that, those personality structures is where we find refuge, I don't know about you, I'm losing. But in the awareness, I'm not. Because you can't lose there. And the awareness can know the kind of strange thoughts I have or grumbling, moaning ideas that come up into mind. Oh, that's just the stuff in awareness. And that's the beauty of this practice, is that you don't have to have perfect thinking patterns, but you do have to start to notice the end of thought. If you're not going to notice the end of thought, then so be it. Better get some perfect personality patterns. But in the end of thought, you begin to see the cessation of thought, and your mind begins to abide more in silence rather than thinking. Your mind begins to gravitate more to the emptiness of the mind rather than the attachment to thinking. Your mind begins to appreciate that, begins to be that more and more, because it's the perfect alternative. It's where perfection lies, and it's so very, very simple. There are many ways to touch the silence of the mind. Tactile things are good. Some beads. If you have 108 beads or 10 beads or malas are quite, you know, Christian tradition has them, and the Islamic tradition, the Buddhist tradition. Just take a set of beads and just touch them. And in the touching, just be the knowing. And you're there. And then touch another one. And you're there. And touch another one. And you're there. Because that tactile sensation requires awareness. And it's not complicated. Thinking mind's complicated. That's how people use beat. Well, I don't know. That's the way I use beat. You just touch it. You just learn to listen, say. You know, we use very simple things, just like listen to the fan. And then listen to the changing nature of the fan. It's different, isn't it, if you listen? And what is that listening about? It's not about desire. It's about perceiving change. And this is one of the ways the Buddha says you touch the unconditioned. You touch the silence of the mind. Because when I listen to that, through the perception of change, that brings me back to the silence of the mind. Desire doesn't listen to change. It listens to quality. So when Chris asked me, should I leave the fan on? I said, take it out, because that was my desire mind. My desire mind didn't like the loud noise. So desire likes quality, right, or quantity. So it likes quietness, it doesn't like clappiness. But the knowing doesn't prefer. The desire mind prefers, and that's fine. Again, it's not wrong. But when I listen through the perception of change, and I'm not listening through desire, I'm listening through what we call lakkhana samadhi, or the characteristic of focus, focusing on a characteristic of all experience. And all experience, all sense experience, has a nature to change. That's why we talk about anicca so much, not because it's an obvious thing, but more as a tool for coming back to the unconditioned. So by noticing the changing nature of the conditioned, that brings me back to the unconditioned. Do that with something difficult like fear. Body component, mental component, emotional component, powerful stuff. And have the presence of mind, develop the presence of mind to move away from the narrative and focus on the changing nature of fear. That takes a lot of presence of mind, doesn't it? Be in a safe environment, obviously. If a bear is chasing you, I suggest don't do this. Obviously. So you're in a social situation, you feel awkward, or you feel shy or fearful. Use that and look at the changing nature of fear. And fear is not constant. It has a different energy. It has heat. It affects the heart. It affects the belly, and the narratives go on. It's changing. And if I have the presence of mind to perceive change within a very difficult condition, that very condition takes me to the unconditioned, to the silence of the mind, oddly enough. And this is where it gets very powerful. Very, very powerful. Because now you use the very stuff that tends to overwhelm you and cause you the deepest suffering. You tend to use that to gain access to the most beautiful part of the human possibility, the deep silence of the heart. Everything takes you there. Fear, love, hate, hot, cold. They all take you there. As we notice cessation, and as we perceive things through, this is what we call anicca sanya, or the perception of change, or mindfulness, keeping in mind the changing nature of things. So that the ideas of mindfulness, you're keeping something in mind, you're remembering something. Anapanasati, I'm remembering the breath. Mindfulness of precepts, I'm remembering my moral commitments. Mindfulness of my responsibilities, I'm remembering to finish the work I promised to finish on time, etc. Mindfulness of change is sustaining the perception of change, and that's a kind of focus. But it's not to focus on an object to get rid of other objects, it's to focus on all objects without choosing an object. This is more subtle. Do it with a fan. Notice how it brings you to silence. But what you have to do is you have to pay attention, you have to let go of thinking. If I'm focusing on the sound of the fan and I'm thinking, is the fan changing or not? Where is it changing? I'm thinking. I'm not really focused, I'm not attentive. But notice the change and hold that perception for long periods of time. Do it a lot. Do it a lot. And then that keeps bringing you back to the unconditioned, and that begins to have a power in your heart, in your mind, in consciousness. And if you do it for something very mundane and ordinary, then it starts to click in for that which is more complicated, more difficult. Because it's applicable to all things, to all things. All right? I'll leave that for you. Reflection.
Handamayam dhammagataya sadhu karam tadamase sadhu 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 anumodami.
Any questions for anyone? Comments? Disagreements? Complaints?
Ajahn. It seems like the important thing, from what I understand, is remembering this, because it's so easy to forget it.
Yes.
You get pulled into everything else.
Yes. That's why retreats, regular sittings, readings, imagery, iconography, anything that brings you back to that. I use iconography a lot. I love Buddha images. And not as idolatry, but as a remembrance. You know? I have pictures of my teachers. I'm festooned with pictures of beings. Ramana Maharshi and Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho and my first teacher and my mother and my dad. And it's all these things. Wake up! You know, and I've got a little Buddha by my computer. And I used to have one, and I printed out infinite patience, boundless compassion. I used that for 2 years. I just use that all the time. Infinite paintings, boundless compassion. I've written down everywhere it says. It's very simple things. It's the persistence, you know? It's the patient persistence in this recalcitrant mind of ours, the kind of endless twaddle the mind brings up, right? It just goes on and on sometimes. You have to be very diligent, very diligent. It's not the diligence of self-mortification. It's not that. It's not harsh at all. It's like you say, it's remembering again and again and again and again and trusting in awareness. If I would say what Buddhist faith is, it's that. It's that awakened mind rather than in a ideology and so on and so forth. And quite often, you know, the mind's stuff it throws up, it seems so unmanageable and difficult. Oh, I'm never going to get through this. Just keep trusting in awareness. Just keep with that. That's what my teachers have said, and it does work. But sometimes you go through the kind of valleys, the valleys of difficulty, that like depression and so monastic life. You know, I've had years, like a couple of years of boredom. Because it's a very boring life, actually. Until you get to the silence of the mind. And it's, oh, God. Pali chanting again. this guy's out of tune next to me. And really, you know, your mind just kind of complaining all the time. And no, you know, keep awakening. Because for me, it was the desire mind had been able to do what it wanted. Rough, you know, as a young traveler, and then all of a sudden cold turkey. So that's part of what we're up against, is we have the karma of the desire mind having lots of avenues of distraction. And then taking some of those avenues away deliberately, like on a retreat. You like, well, retreat's interesting, isn't it? You do a 10-day retreat, first 3 days is pathetic. You know, people are just lolling about, they're falling asleep. You know, I just didn't want to say anything. Because I'm sure hatred is going to shut up, you know, or something. And then, you know, fourth, fifth day, all these little angels floating around. Not quite so simple. But it's very true, you know, people work through non-distraction, they work through awareness of dullness, of restlessness, of boredom, but they're not seeking another object. They're just staying with this object until it ceases, and the mind's bright. And they think, well, why didn't that happen the first day? Right? You have to build up the barami, the strength of it.
I sort of had the feeling you were saying that helping this ability to become aware and maintain awareness is a goal, but isn't that also a method?
Both, yeah. The method has to enter into the goal somehow. They have to be conjoined, right? If they're totally separate, then the method could never touch the goal. Didn't get it.
Don't get it.
Anyway, it is. I need a cup of coffee on that one.
When you talked about generosity and compassion, these other things, I mean, my sense is that the ability to become aware leads us in that direction, the ability to let go of objects and to see our condition is what gives us the ability to discriminate and make the decisions.
Right.
And that's sort of the goal. And awareness being, you need awareness if you're not going to get distracted and caught up in.
But it's not just a tool. It's more than a tool. Huh? It's not just a tool. If you think it's a tool, then you're always the doer using this tool to be mindful. And what I'm suggesting is let go of the doer and be the awareness itself. And then that gets you beyond the method. Otherwise, you're always using this tool called mindfulness and awareness, and you're always the doer, mucking around with your engine, getting it, you know, tuning it up right, but you don't see the very doer as an object. You remain as the doer. There is doing, but to see the doer as an object in itself, you know, awareness begins to know awareness. And then there's no language, but that's home. You come home, right? So if it was just left as a tool, then that would be a limited definition. Because the sense of self falls away in awareness.
That's interesting. So I think the natural result of exposing yourself to that condition, is what opens the heart, I think, and leads to compassion and peace and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly, yeah. And you realize that awareness is not just the method, it is the goal. Because there's nowhere else to go, you've done it. And the idea that I have to go somewhere in time is the delusion of self.
Are you not talking about sort of a refined state?
You can't, awareness you can't really define as, you can't give it a quality. If you say refined, then you have to get rid of coarse. You could say it's refined, but you think about it, like the awareness of the mosquito bite was neither refined nor coarse. The experience was coarse. So as soon as you give awareness any color, the danger is, like even the word peace has still a coloring to it. It's still dualistic. It's still peace as opposed to war. And that's why awareness is such a mystery. You know, it's such a mystery. And yet, it's always here. So what kind of life can I live where that awakened mind is a natural way of functioning? Whereas consumer society is doing the opposite. Right? It's saying, what kind of a life can I persuade you into so you purchase more? Right? And its hooks are very powerful now. You know, they have the best psychologists working to make sure you buy their widgets. So it's very very different. Peter, one here and then the gentleman in the back.
Adam, you spoke about the skill of using mindfulness to back away from negative thoughts and emotions like fear.
Did I say that?
That's what I heard.
That's not what it said. Back away implies...
To release...
I didn't say that either. I remember my talk, which is rare. Try again. What did I say?
You talked about using awareness to deal with, in a skillful manner, negative emotions, which are very distasteful.
I did the opposite. I said use fear to know awareness.
And vice versa?
No. Sorry. You're the opposite. You're the doer trying to fix up awareness to fix up fear. I'm saying, don't be the doer. Fear points to awareness.
Okay, so sit there in awareness. And watch.
Use fear to know awareness. Just like I use the discernment of in and out breath, right? I can feel that in and out breath, in is different than out, in texture, right? And that, as I abide, as that discerning, I'm emphasizing awareness. Discern the changing nature of fear. As you abide in discerning, in discernment of fear, points to awareness. The fan, notice the changing nature of the fan will point you to awareness. I'm not trying to fix fear.
But it's a very skillful way of dealing with fear.
It's the end of fear. Well, that's not my priority. Get it?
I'd also like to
scratch the head.
I'd also like to deal with fear, but you say turn it around.
Yeah, all conditions point you to the unconditioned. Now, having said that, if someone has a panic attack and they need medicine, fine. I don't know. You know, I don't have that. I've had a lot of fear. So there are ways, cognitive ways, to help people get a handle on fear, certainly. And you have to deal with the fear. But now, we're doing post-grad. Okay, you're not an undergrad. So if you're an undergrad, I'd say, you know, like, give the fear a cup of tea and notice it in the breath and do pranayama. We do all that business, right? But we're doing grad work right now. And this is the most direct path. The others you have to do, certainly. And I would not recommend this to someone who actually would. I'd probably do the same thing, but they'd have to hear it. If they couldn't hear it, then I'd figure something else out.
So would you do the same with positive emotions?
Positive, yep.
Appreciation, gratitude,
yep.
Love.
I'd use positive, like, let's say if I do, like, I quite often think of my mom, and I bring her up into consciousness, and that opens the heart, let her go. And it's very easy to abide in awareness because the heart is very open. It doesn't want anything.
Would you not want to dwell in the thoughts of your mother, the positive emotion?
What for? it's a condition.
It's pleasant. Okay.
I want to go beyond pleasant.
Yeah, okay.
I don't want to live in duality. I mean, I like coffee, actually. With sugar.
Did the Buddha not say on the right effort to be aware of negative thoughts and learn how to let go of them and positive thoughts, cultivate them?
Sure.
To reside in?
That's the prescription.
Is that the undergraduate?
Yeah. I mean, that's what we all get. We got that from as we were kids, right? You know, share your toys, Johnny, with Sally. Right, so we've got generosity as kids. So you've been doing that all your life, right? So, yeah, sure, that makes sense. don't do non-generosity, but take it a step more. What is, you know, for me, it's always, what is the spiritual life? Is it just about being a good person? Or is there more? That's why I say, you know, goodness is a method. I'm not advocating, you know, just dwelling in depressed states of mind and plotting murder on your neighbors and so on. So I kind of assume this is in place for most of us. Most of us have, you know, we've done that work, or we respect that work, we understand that work, right? Hey, yeah, good people. And anyone robbed the bank recently? Or, you know, so that I just assume that's a given when I come to these meetings. But the trouble with that is that you're constantly preoccupied with the negative and the positive. And that's the downside. I mean, you have to work with it, sure, but at some point, you just kind of, why am I so negative? Why shouldn't I? I should develop more positive. Why shouldn't I? And you're just in the conditioned realm. Your mind's always thinking about conditions. You never get to the unconditioned. So, you know, having a good life in place and getting all that, and then, this is the more interesting part, for me at least. I mean, that's why I'm in the business. Question in the back?
That's tough to follow.
Hard act to follow.
The last time I felt any sense of silence was 27 years ago with Bhaktivedanta Chah. And, a Zen monk said that it's easy to be a Buddha in the realm of the Buddha, but better to be a Buddha in the realm of the devil. And since then,
what's your question?
The question is that my heart's grown awful neat, and the idea of being awake or knowing silence again seems like infinite countless awake.
And you need therapy.
I need a little practical advice.
You need therapy. This ain't the place for you. You need a good therapist that can help you work through this.
Okay.
When your mind is really, really troubled, you need people to talk to that have skills, that understand your particular karmic predicament, that have the patience and time and skill. You know, there are so many skills now in therapy methods. So many good people who work specifically like with drug addiction, or, you know, there's so many good things. So this isn't for everyone. It's not for everyone, but there are many good things you can do. So if you feel your mind is like hopelessly out far from silence, then that's a very important thing to listen to and find someone who can guide you in your particular predicament. I'm not a therapist. I'm a monk, and this is the stuff I do, and I like to share. But I don't have the skills of a therapist. I don't, you know, I've not been trained that way. So find someone. Can't see it now. Next question. Yes.
So. When what you refer to as the deep silence of the mind,
uh-huh.
When one is able to touch that, isn't there pleasure in abiding in that?
Yes. Very pleasant, yeah.
And
pleasure's not wrong.
Because you were saying notice the pleasant as an object.
Yeah.
So if being in awareness is pleasant, then...
If you notice the pleasure, it goes to equanimity and more silence. If you don't notice the pleasure, then you get attached to it, and then when noise comes, you've lost the plot.
But what if you don't, and noise comes, and not being affected by noise is pleasant?
Just stay with that. Yeah, let it be what it is. Right, you know, because whatever the perception is or the experience is, the sense of, like Ajahn Sumedho, it all belongs, right? It all belongs, pleasant or unpleasant. So if it's pleasant, fine, just be grateful or whatever. But keep going back to the awareness rather than the experience that has a changing. That's why the perception of change is so important in Buddhism, Anicca Sanya, because that's the thing that always keeps you from attachment. Now that perspective, that focus. You know, like in Buddhism, we have jhanas, which are the kind of highly focused states of mind, absorbed states of mind. But we also have a kind of focus which is called lakkhana samadhi, or the samadhi which is on the characteristic of change. And in the first sutta, the Buddha says, Kundanyo knows. What does he know? He knows that that which is a nature to arise is a nature to change. And why does the Buddha say that in that first sermon? Why does he say that? You think, well, you know, is he just kind of figured something out? You and I know that things change. It's because Kundanyo is focused on that. He sees that's the way out. That's the way out. Focusing on change. Right? So when we have doubts or questions about these things, just see it as don't know mine. Right? Because there's nothing to figure out. You see the limit of intellect. Because doubt is an object. It seeks its resolution through an answer. But of course, every answer you get other doubts. Science has shown that. But when you know doubt is doubt, and you don't have the need for a conclusion. We have a great, intellectuals have this great need for conclusions. Like intellectuals love charts. Like you love that chart. Remember I showed you that in the monastery? Mm-hmm. There's this chart of Buddhism. It's like a mandala and all kinds of, and Andre says, oh, I like that. He says, what is this chart? So, you think, oh, yeah, that's it. It's a nice codification. It's all a nice package. But life is not a chart. Life's just a mess. So, that's what the intellect likes. It likes a nice package, nicely defined. But silence is not a nice package. It just knows the desire for packages and conclusions. That's how you get beyond the intellect. Right? That's the great challenge for intellectuals, is that because we love thought. I like interesting ideas and so on, but I've seen in my own practice, I read something complicated, right? Try to read something complicated, and my mind would, say, well, that's brilliant, that's brilliant, that's brilliant. And I just end up thinking I'm stupid. And I've learned how not to read things like that. Because I don't like to be stupid. But that's what the intellect does. It always, if I just know a little bit more. Here we're just seeing thought as thought. Because this moment has no conclusion. It's just like this, isn't it? It's just like this. And that simplicity is beautiful. It's beautiful. Yes?
Is that just like trusting that everything has its place? Is that sort of like a fate?
That's a conclusion.
No.
Yeah, it's a theory.
But it works.
Okay, good. Use theories as not ultimate positions, but just as tools.
So just to be aware of awareness and not label it, that just...
karma. Let's say karma. We have the ideas of karma, right? Some people take it fatalistically, crime and punishment kind of thing. It's a very Western way of looking at it. But I just use it as a hypothesis. I don't know. I haven't got a psychic bone in my body, right? Don't know. But makes sense. Buddha said it. So I kind of use it as a working hypothesis. So if something happens to me, and good or bad, I think, maybe it's good karma, bad karma. But I don't really think too much about it. Because if I think about it,
Does it take you out of awareness, just chalking it up to karma?
No, it just takes me to a place of acceptance. That's the way Buddhists use it. It's basically not fatalism. It's just my karma to sleep for another 4 hours this morning. Right? More ice cream, more karma. That's rational. Yeah. But just to use theoretical hypotheses. If you take some of these hypotheses and you keep thinking about them, you always find anomalies and, they'll just spin you out. But I just use it like, why did I become a monk? my parents didn't raise me to be a monk. They're very unsuspecting, actually. And why? You know, why am I? I said, well, probably past lives, and you know, I was a monk in a past life. Makes sense. But if you came to me and said, rubbish, I said, yeah, maybe you're right. So let's just. I'll finish with a story. Great story. We were talking about this the other morning. Ajahn Sumedho, my teacher, American, who was a senior disciple of Ajahn Chah, 1980, he went from England on a trip back to Thailand. He hadn't been back for several years. And he took about 15 lay people with him. And there was a nun, a Buddhist nun, in Ajahn Chah's monastery. Her name was Kamfa. She used to have blonde hair. She shaved her head. Kamfa means golden top, Thai. And she's a really strong woman and prodigious kind of meditator. And Lompo Sumedho was praising her to all these people going to England. They're all going to Thailand. They're all really looking forward to seeing Ajahn Chah and seeing this very strong meditator, Buddhist nun. So Lompa Sumedho arrives at Wat Bapong and goes to finds out that actually she's converted to Christianity. A born again Christian had gone to the monastery and converted her. And Lompa Sumedho says, well, that's difficult. Now what are we going to say to these people? So he goes to Ajahn Chah. He goes to Ajahn Chah and he says, Lompa, she's converted to Christianity. And Lompa looks at her, he looks at Ajahn Sumedho and says, well, maybe she's right. Let's close with some chanting.